Hey everybody, a few quick things. One, this episode is from ICFA, which means there are some audio issues. It's pretty listenable. It's just, it'll sound different than normal. You know that if you've been listening to our previous episodes. The other thing I just want to say is that the Worldcon fundraiser I was doing is done. It's completed. I've raised all $2,200. I've got my ticket. The only thing I've got left is basically hotel, and, you know, random stuff. So everything's funded. I really want to say thank you. If you were a listener and you donated, you're awesome. And I appreciate it, and, you know, it doesn't matter who you were and how much you donated, even, like, $5 was a lot of help. So thanks, everybody, for the support. I really, really appreciate it. And there'll be more information because there's obviously stuff that has to do with the fundraiser, like perks and stuff that have to be released. But, yeah, so you'll hear from me later. But in any case, I hope you enjoy this episode, and I hope to see you all at Worldcon.
It's one small step for man,
but the crow forgot one thing, it's monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to this Giving Funny Show. I'm Sean.
I'm Julia.
And our special guest is... Oh, well, you go for it. Say your name.
I am Ken. Say my name.
Also, it's really kind of late.
It's about
so we've been
10.
Podcasting, like, all day long.
It's wonderful. It's great.
And I just drank something called a bourbon and Kahlua shot, which is probably
not... Was
that
good?
It tasted like bourbon and Kahlua, which, it wasn't bad.
I can't tell if those tastes would be good together or not.
I mean, I would have preferred perhaps a Fernet or a, maybe even a Jägermeister, but it got the job did.
You're properly toasted for this?
I'm toasted. Let's host it.
So we are still at ICFA, the International Conference for the Fantastic and the Arts, and one of the things that I heard about this conference forever before I ever came was that the bar and the pool are both amazing, and so David is here as an example of that.
I am. I'm here as an example because I haven't been anywhere but the bar or the pool. I am planning on going to my first... thing in a room tomorrow at 10:30 because somebody said you should come hear me read, and that sounded like a nice thing to do.
That is a nice thing to do. I was just sad that the bar, inside and outside, neither place do they give you an umbrella and your drink. And so, like, Ellen Klages had to resort to bringing umbrellas in.
I saw that Klages had smuggled an umbrella.
No, she had, like, bought a pack and she was passing them out to people. I don't know if she has any left, but, like, she was carrying them in the back of her badge. And then when people were like, I want an umbrella in my drink, she'd be like, here. Because the hotel's not going to provide, so Ellen has to.
I saw one in her in the back of her badge and was suitably embarrassed. I mean, envious. I was embarrassed because of what she threatened to do with the umbrella.
You were embarrassed.
I was embarrassed. It happens a lot.
Or envious.
It was... Oh, that's an actual envious word. Envious. Oh, no, that's not.
So I learned it. I learned a new word recently from my devastatingly handsome friend Jeffrey. You might remember him from all the torture cinema references.
Which you always mention. Yeah.
So he works, like, doing legal transcription and stuff. And the word that he taught all of our friend group this week is burglarious.
Burglarious.
That's a real word that appears in legal, like, proceedings. Like, someone could do something with burglarious intent.
Is it like a burglar?
I but hope
you
so.
You have burglarious intent, probably.
I mean, I often have burglarious intent. And when I was in band camp, I had buglarious intent. But never had bulgarious. Well, that's not true. I have a Bulgarian friend who gives me bulgarious intent. Darn it.
You have a book out through tour.
Oh shit, that's right. We are supposed to talk.
We're
about
supposed to like
things.
Make your publicist happy.
Oh right. Hi Artie, I love you. I do. I have a book out from tour. My very first book came out in February. It is called The Waking Engine.
Tell us what is it about.
It is apparently the genre is new weird. I did not know this until they told me I was new weird. I just thought I was regular weird. it is largely urban fantasy, also some afterlife fiction thrown in. But because it's weird, I'm allowed not to have an elevator pitch, which is good because I can't do an elevator pitch. But the quick, slightly longer than an elevator pitch version is, it is set in a multiverse in which every time you die, you wake up as yourself, as Julia, as Sean on a new world, and you move from world to world, life after life after life, and eventually, after many, many lives, you come to a city, the City Unspoken, which is where my story is set, which is sort of like the anti-New York, that if people go to New York to make it big, you go to this city to finally die, to achieve moksha, or release from the wheel of life and cease to be, and antics ensue.
That sounds fascinating.
Thank you.
So you're dealing a lot with this idea of the afterlife, but also the... I guess kind of like a form of reincarnation.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely... A character in the book says, what afterlife? What's afterlife? There's just life. And that's sort of the kernel of my idea, was that I always thought it was kind of ridiculous to think that, oh, after this very long, arduous life, if I'm good, this long, interesting life, if I'm good, I can go sit on a cloud and play a harp forever. That sounded like a punishment to me. So I thought, what would be a better... And I've always tried to come up with what would be better afterlives. Mm. And I failed because the best afterlife I could think of was just more life. And then that became sort of its own question to pursue. And then I thought, well, what happens when surely at some point you get tired or have done everything a million times and want to rest?
And you end up in this city.
And then you end up in this city. And there are plenty of people in the city who are not there to die. You know, somebody's there just to make money and sell cheeseburgers and, you know, do a little hooking and sell
while people
drugs.
Are planning to be gone.
Yes.
They just want a cheeseburger for the go? Is that?
Well, I mean, just like New York, there's a guy who's got to clean the streets. There's a guy who sells apples on the streets. He doesn't care if you're there to make it on Broadway. His job is to sell apples, and if you're going to live another day, you're going to need to eat an apple. So even if you're not going to go for a little while, you've still got to be in a place, and where there's a place, there are things, and where there are things, there are...
There's infrastructure.
Yes, exactly.
To service you in your path to death.
So it's a book about infrastructure. No.
And there are people with burglarious intent in this city?
In fact, there are people with burglarious intent in this city. you might even see a character who might share a name with a former U.S. president who himself... has some burglarious intent or burglarious or otherwise criminal inclinations. Excuse me. That word was harder than
I should have been.
Nixon! Have you read the book, or are you just guessing?
No, I'm just guessing. I'm like, U.S. Yes. president, criminal intent, Nixon.
He's kind of the default, though, in a lot of respects.
I have a young Dickensian street urchin named Nixon, and I will not say more, but...
Alright.
Dickensian street urchin. He's very specific.
Yes!
Sort of like an Oliver Twist.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Artful Dodger.
If the Artful Dodger and Miss Havisham conspired to elect a president and then reincarnate him as their child with burglarious intent.
And you wonder why you're the new weird.
Yes! I didn't say I was surprised. I just didn't know they capitalized it. Okay? I always knew I was weird. I just didn't think somebody made a living selling that.
So, I guess the question I have is, it doesn't seem like something I've heard of before in fantasy. It's not certainly not common. Maybe that's why they call it the new weird, because it's new.
Haven't heard of the new weird?
No, I've heard of the new weird. Okay. No, this idea of... I mean, I've heard of, like, you know, reincarnation. Like, that comes from, obviously, even human myths, but... That you go to other worlds, and then eventually, like, you've hit all the worlds, and then you go to a place where you, presumably, like, you just poof, and that's it.
So what was kind of the impetus for this idea? I mean, what were you thinking when you decided I wanted to structure this?
You know, I started writing it in 2003, and I wrote about three chapters, and I thought, this is too weird. And because nobody told me that that was actually a viable thing that you could do, I thought that was a bad thing. I said, this is too weird. I don't even know how to finish it, let alone sell it to anybody. So I put it in a drawer and I forgot about it until I had a chance meeting with the woman who eventually became my agent, and she told me to finish it and come back when I had, if I could finish it. And so I thought, you know, I heard RuPaul whisper in my ear, don't fuck it up.
Yes, very good.
She's still whispering, don't fuck it up. You could still fuck it up. And I went off and I came back a year later and I had finished it. So really, I mean, I don't want to sound like I didn't want to write the book, but because I did very much want to write the book, and I was very happy to be told that I could, to be given permission to write the book. But it wasn't like I had this burning tale inside of me that I just had to get out. It was something that was kind of, she said, this is a good idea, go with it. And I did, I just went with it. But I think, to actually answer your question, there is a lot of me in the book. There is a lot of 9/11 and post-9/11 New York in the book, which is where I was living when I wrote it. I lived in New York for 12 years. And there is a great deal of one gay man being me, one gay man's sort of journey into adulthood, and this idea that you go away from home and you go somewhere and you try to become who you want to be. Also, another thing that has to do with queerdom and gayness is that as somebody who is of the post-AIDS generation, you know, I didn't see all of my friends die, but I did grow up in a world where the people immediately above me had lost everybody and did refer to it as the Holocaust. So there's, for me, very much this non-funny intersection of freedom and sex and death, just from being a gay man in the world. And I needed to explore that in some way other than shagging my brains out. So I did it in a way that my mother could appreciate.
Hi, Mom! Mother of
twins. Yep. She was my beta reader.
One of them. She really?
Wow. Oh, yeah. My mom will go there. She has no fear.
That's fascinating. So you actually had your mom read your work.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. I have my mom read almost everything. She's sort of my patronus. In fact, that was a question. Who is your patronus? And it could totally be.
That's awesome.
Does she have, like, antlers? Because now I'm imagining.
She has, like, giant blonde steel magnolias hair, which is wispy and patronus materially.
Okay.
So I can just... Really, it's just her hair that is my patronus. It's sort of Mom and Dolly Parton thing that shoots out of my wand and scares away the Dementor.
I would be afraid of Dolly Parton's hair,
right?
Mentor.
Yep, like, that's why I'm
like
still alive.
Like a big cloud of wispy sunshine.
Mm-hmm. And sass.
And sass.
And sass.
Amazing. So, has your mom always read your work from the beginning? Like,
No, I don't think I showed her stuff when I was in high school or in college. Mm. I mean, she would always read some... My parents would always read some things that I was proud of or that I wanted feedback on. And I still don't show them absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom is just simply a good reader. Mm-hmm. And I it's less about, Mommy, look what I did, and more about honestly getting her opinion, because she's pretty dead on right when it comes to telling me what to do. So when she and my editor agree, then I know it's good. And when they disagree, I listen to my editor.
We won't tell your mom you said that. What's her name?
She's listening right now.
Yeah, my mom likes to read everything I've written, but I don't let her read anything until it's actually published. So she has to, like, go and buy things. Like,
that's,
I don't even give her
smart
free copies. I like that she wants to support me and does that, but I'm just super... Oh, no, you're reading my stuff.
Well, I'm an oversharer, so oddly, I won't necessarily share something with her unless it's really emotionally impactful, in which case it's usually pretty traumatizing for a mother to read. I mean, right. I've shared stories with her about, you know, all kinds of dark materials. or if I need feedback, but I don't know, I don't share everything, but I share the worst.
Well, that's really cool that you have a mom who's like supportive and a good reader. That's very exciting.
Yes, I am here because of her. She's my
You are quite literally here because of her. Be in her body for 9 months.
She bargained to have me in her body, in fact. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your path to publication, because you met your agent, and then now you're with Tor. I mean,
I have a very very I have a very bizarre path to publication, have had in fact a very bizarre life in general, in the sense that I keep rolling 20s when I shouldn't. And I'm the first to say I don't deserve it. It's not I am not proof that life is a meritocracy. But I got an agent before I finished a book. She said I brought it to her and she said, cut 100 pages and change the ending. And I did. And I brought it back and she shopped it to 7 publishers and one of them was Tor, and that was the only one, they were the only one who nibbled. In fact, they just bought it. So, and then my editor said, cut 100 pages and change the ending. And I did. And then when I brought it back to him, he said, okay, this is actually what a book looks like when I buy it normally for the first time. So next time around, you might want to aim for
that.
What you've achieved 2 edits in. And I'm 60,000 words into the sequel. I'm 600,000 words into the sequel, so I'm going to be cutting 100 pages a lot. But I'm 60,000 words into the sequel, and I am trying very hard to aim for something more like what I brought to my editor at Tor the second time around, which was his first time around.
Okay, so when you started this particular book, or when you finished this particular book, did you intend it to be the start of a series, or were you originally thinking of standalone?
I did. No, I wanted it to be a series simply because I was still of the mindset, and am still of the mindset, that the story I had ended up trying to tell was too weird and too big and too unwieldy to fit into a single volume, and as evidenced by two different people on either side of the professional spectrum telling me to cut 100 pages and change the ending. You know, that's not for nothing. So I envisioned it as a multi-book story, and I envisioned it as a quadrilogy or quartet or tetralogy or whatever the hell we're supposed to call it. For no other reason than I was sick of reading trilogies and didn't want to suffer from the Two Towers syndrome. So I rolled the dice, and I will either have 2 crappy middle books, or I will avoid the middle book where nothing happens but middle syndrome entirely. So we'll see. That was a gamble, but it was a totally arbitrary gamble.
So We've got kind of abstract detail about the book in terms of the sort of setting of the world. So what is the main thrust of, in terms of the plot? So we've figured out who the character is, obviously.
Well, no, that's just a side character.
One character.
He's just plucky comic relief.
Like you. Yay!
Kind of just like me. What actually happens in the story is that the mechanism behind True Death is breaking down, and so people are no longer allowed... able to cease to be, and this has broad repercussions sort of in the same way it would in any ecosystem, where if there is input and no output, shit goes crazy. And so that's sort of the larger structural plot goings on. And then specifically, the protagonist is a queer New Yorker, shocker, who wakes up in this city and knows nothing of how he got there, and is shocked to learn that he might have died. and is further shocked to learn absolutely every detail of the world. And it is his job or his purview or however you want to describe it to fix that problem with death, or not. And he's sort of caught up in a power play between various other characters in the city, and a sadistic fairy princess and a cyborg fairy queen and undead prostitutes who cannot die, and Anna Wintour-inspired liches. All of my liches are basically Meryl Streep in A Devil Wears Prada. And I quote the movie. They quote the movies. I'm a big fan of just literally putting the words of your inspiration into your character's mouth to see what happens. So that's not hidden. I mean, one of my liches just straight up quotes A Devil Wears Prada. And that's how I get through the day.
That's so usually your main character wakes up and is sort of alarmed to find out that he might have died. So when your characters just die and they find themselves in a different world, do they have all the recollections of their previous lives?
Yes. It's more like Cylon resurrection than Hindu resurrection. Mm-hmm. You're not going to wake up as anybody other than yourself. Now, you may wake up younger or older, depending on how you see yourself and or the quirks of random chance. So you might, for instance, be a dead president who wakes up as a prepubescent boy, or you might be a beautiful woman who wakes up as an older woman, because that's how she sees herself.
Okay.
But you're still you.
And what's basically changed is the world.
Yeah, you're in a completely new universe. Mm-hmm. So the first time it's a shock, and there are places like in our world, it's a primary secondary fiction, in that it's a largely secondary world, but our world is in it somewhere. I mean, since the main character comes from New York, it has to be. So there are worlds like ours where nobody comes anyway other than from birth. And then there are worlds where people wake up and or are born. But after your first death will always be, your first reincarnation will always be, often be a shock. And then thereafter the ten or 100 or 100,000 times you...
If you're born in a world where this is something that people die and they wake up in that world, do you then know that this is something that will happen to you? Okay.
Yes. For instance, if you were born in the City Unspoken and there are people who live in the city, just like like I was saying, I mean, not everybody is there to die.
Right.
So if your mom runs a store on the street selling shoes and you are born there, you wake up thinking that death is a part of commerce, the same way that we think of sex as part of commerce or shoes as part of commerce.
That's fascinating. Out of curiosity, have you seen the Miracle Day, I guess, miniseries of Torchwood?
I stopped. I saw the first two or three seasons. I have not seen the Miracle Day.
Okay.
It's on my queue, you know, but I haven't gotten around to it. But please, you don't have to. You can spoil it for me if you want to.
I mean, the main thing is it does have an obvious connection with your book, in that basically people can stop dying. They don't die, but instead of obviously where you have the kind of a form of reincarnation, that it's just the world. It has obviously different repercussions. And it's one of the things I loved about Miracle Day is I think Torchwood's best when it has the series sequence and it's all one narrative.
Yeah.
And Miracle Day, like, it just, you start to see people doing things in response, trying to find the quote, the solution to all this. And of course, sometimes the solutions they come up with to fix the problem are horrific. Because they're humans in desperation.
Yes. Like,
how do we fix this? What do we do? Well, maybe burn the bodies.
I don't know if I need to watch this or stay away from it, but it sounds related.
Did you watch Children of Earth?
No, I stopped when they. Am I allowed to say spoilers on here?
Spoiler for Torchwood stuff. So
I stopped when they killed Toshi.
Mm, yeah,
I just that season at the end of that season, and not because I had any kind of like.
No, but
outrage against killing Toshi. I just, that was the end of it. They killed off a large part of the cast, and I went on to something else.
Yeah, we watched up through Children of Earth, and we watched the first couple of episodes of Miracle Day, and I was like, I have not enjoyed this, and I'm just gonna be done now.
It's got Bill Pullman.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I was just...
Bill Pullman.
No.
The Bill Pullman?
Yes, the Bill Pullman.
Does he fly into the spaceship to save us?
No, but he's, like, a little bit portly and old, and he, like, has, like, a southern accent.
No, you should just go watch Independence Day again.
Okay!
You can just
listen. He's much younger and cuter than that anyway.
Well, you know, I mean, there are similarly things. You know, you're right in saying that this is a new-ish idea, in that I'm not following in a long tradition of hack and slash or space opera or something that I grew up loving and wanted to emulate. But there are there are definitely parallels. I have not read Riverworld. I have heard that around the tour office, the elevator pitch for my book is, it's Riverworld in the city. Which is not a bad elevator pitch if you're going to pitch in an elevator.
Yeah, and if you want to go way back, like, Death Takes a Holiday is basically the idea that, like, death has taken a holiday and is no longer killing people, and oops, that's a problem. But it sounds like there's a lot more going on with the complex sort of universe building and the characters specifically that you're following.
Yeah, for me, while I am incredibly inspired by the movie Death Becomes Her, two people cannot die, the repercussions are less matter of fact and more along the lines of a giant multiverse drowning sickness, that mental and physical sickness that swamps the world to sort of the gears of things get gummed up, and the gears inside you get gummed up. We'll be exploring that more in the second book. Out in May of 2015.
Does the first book actually end with any kind of resolution, or is it the kind of book where we're going to be, like, immediately wanting to read the sequel?
It definitely ends with a resolution. I would not go so far as to call it self-contained, because there is clearly more to come.
But yeah, there's a difference between a series book. For me, I like to read series books, but I like to be able to pick something up and know that, like, when I get to the end of the book, I'm not going to feel really frustrated that I can't immediately pick up the next one.
There's definitely not going to be a note from George R. R. Martin at the end of the book saying that, I'm sorry, this is only half a book.
Exactly.
The next one will come in 2005. But wait, it won't really come until 2012.
I was reading Maureen Johnson, who writes YA, and she has two different series. One's like contemporary kind of rom-com, and one's sort of paranormal scary. And both of them, the second books have been out, but the third book isn't out. And in both of those series, she ends book two on just straight up a cliffhanger. And
no.
I was like, because I have no idea when the third books in those series are going to come out.
Yeah.
And she's writing them in tandem, so it's like, you're going to wait a long time no matter what.
No, my protagonist makes a complete journey. My antagonists have resolution of some kind.
Okay.
And or evolution of some kind. There are series-long plot arcs that do not get resolved, but do get stepped forward, and then there are book-long plot arcs that get resolved.
Yeah, no,
so
and
no cliffhangers,
I think there's
but more,
a big
yeah,
difference
get,
between
yeah.
sort of resolving the current storyline and, like, making the whole arc continue.
It's not a cliffhanger, but you do see the highway continue into the distance and have to wait a year.
Oh, that's okay. I'm okay with that.
Okay.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah, it's the absence
it's
of revelation.
It's when you actually leave your character hanging off a cliff with a little burglarious intent.
There may or may not be an actual cliff at the end of the book.
Uh-oh.
But nobody is hanging off of it, and I don't want to say any more. But I promise there isn't a cliffhanger, but you will definitely know that the story isn't over.
I actually have a great example which is kind of hilarious when you think about it. If I recall correctly, at the end of Karen Miller's The Innocent Mage, which is followed by The Awakened Mage, they originally were one book, but the publisher was like, we can't know, it's too long, that'd be like $10 billion a book, it's not going to happen. So I split it, and splits it on a cliffhanger in which there is a carriage crash, and I could have sworn the carriage crashes off a cliff, and characters die in it, and that's where the book ends. The first book. So whenever the books are great, but whenever I tell people, it's like, just read them back to back like they're one really long-ass book.
Yeah.
Because any of the things that that the end of this book will leave you wanting for or longing for are not A, B, C, D, and Edison just forgot to put D.
Right.
It's what is happening comes to an end, and you want more, hopefully. Or the story, you realize that the story has more to tell, but you're not actually waiting to find out what happened to A, B, C, or D.
It's just really, like, I was in France, and I was teaching English in France, and I got sick, and I knew I was going to have to take a couple days off work. I didn't have internet at my apartment, so it was like, okay, I'm going to be in bed, I'm going to stop at the English language bookstore on my way home that has, like, one shelf of English language books, and I pay the premium price for an English language book so I don't have to think, and I'm just going to read an English book, so I'm going to buy the fattest book I can find, which turned out to be The Witching Hour by Anne Rice.
Yes.
So I spent the next, like, day or two reading The Witching Hour, which is, like, 1,000 pages long.
Ghostly ravishment.
The bookstore has, like, literally one shelf of books, and The Witching Hour is the only Anne Rice book on that shelf, so there are no other Anne Rice, and I know this. I get to the end of The Witching Hour, and it ends with this point where basically you realize that the whole first book is a setup, and you have no idea what's actually happening in the story at that point. Like, it really is sort of like, wait, what happens next? And not, like, in a sort of, like, well, this is a good resolution. Now I would like to read the continuation. No, it's, like, literally you just don't know what's happening. And you're like, And I'm like, I know I can't even get the next book. This is 2002, so I don't have an e-reader. It's not, you know, you can't just go on to Kindle and be like, hey, give me the second book. No, I was just like, I'm in France and I have no way to get this book. Thanks a lot, Anne Rice.
Well, so I have a similar experience. I have a guilty pleasure in that I am completely addicted to the Laurel K. Hamilton Elfhorn series, is what I call it. I'm sure it has a real name, but it's elf porn to me. And I don't want to spoil anything, although that is generous. but at each book, at the end of each book, I think, well, what other than the fact that I'm on page 400 makes this the end of a book?
Yeah. No, I was teaching that, like, they just basically didn't have more room to print because it would have fallen apart, probably. Is it that's why it's 1,000 pages long, and they were like, you gotta stop here.
Now, unlike Anne Rice with the elf porn books, you're not left burning to see what kind of candy-colored elf she is. The plot forces her to sleep with next. You just know it's gonna be, I don't know, puce. Next up is a puce dude. We'll see you next year. He may spank her. And that's why I'm addicted to them.
Because they're random.
They're random candy-colored men who the protagonist, who I inhabit via to enact my wish fulfillment, gets to sleep with. So I am vicariously sleeping with, you know, a crayon
candy
box full
of candy-colored men.
So do you like the Sookie Stackhouse novels as well?
I have not gotten into the Sookie Stackhouse novels. I have not gotten into the Anita Blake novels. I mean, this is not really my genre. I was actually just at Borderlands in San Francisco, and the staff recommend says, this book is total elf porn. So I bought it, because what idiot doesn't want elf porn?
What idiot indeed.
Not this idiot.
Honestly, you could sell a lot of books if you just put elf porn on it.
Yeah. It worked on me.
Yeah?
But I am not writing
elf porn. You sell a lot of books.
So I should pitch this anthology.
Elf porn? The sequel?
I'm just going to call it elf porn.
Mm-hmm.
You going to write me a story for that?
Sure. Okay. Oh, yeah. We'll Selkie do Does Seattle. You got it. You got the title.
Awesome.
Take that, Brides of Roll Rock Island. I love you, Margo Lanigan. I'm sorry. I'm just kidding.
Well, since we're on the subject of books, presumably things you do read. Who would you say are some of your influences?
I'm hugely influenced by Dune. Frank Herbert was a big deal to me. In fact, the thing I did in this book that I loved more than anything else was writing epigraphs like Frank Herbert does. And I thought, what a cool way to do world building. I'm an obsessive compulsive world builder. So I thought that Dune really inspired me in terms of being able to take do world building in a different modality than your writing, that you have, you can bring in political science, you can bring in ecology, you can bring in poetry, you can bring in a minor character who in her own work is the author. So that's a big influence that you can see on the page and is a big influence in my heart. The other big one for me is a British fantasist named Storm Constantine, whose trilogy Wraithu, Wraethu, because you need two Ths to spell Wraithu, is set in sort of a similar world to our own, in which a race of magical, mostly male hermaphrodites have taken over the world and use gay sex to create magic and are just beautiful and flawless. I don't think she is qualified. I don't think she's weird with a capital W, but she's weird to me.
I like how she's not officially qualified.
You mean
that, she did not pass the weird qualification exam?
You don't want to say somebody is weird because that still sounds like an insult. But she is very weird. And not how I found her, but how many people might find her is that there's always a copy of Wraithu at almost every bookstore. There's at least one. She's a tour author as well. And Neil Gaiman's blurb for her is, "I wouldn't trade her for a dozen Anne Rice's," and that is just dead on accurate. So if you like Anne Rice but wish she were better, sorry.
Or wish she'd like the damn book.
Or end the book, or stop, or something, check out Storm Constantine. She's fabulous. And she's also a witch.
Storm is?
she's a British Wiccan fabulous vision of gothic beauty.
Can't be many of those in our community.
No. I mean, right? It's all John Deere hats up in here.
I mean, there are some.
That's right, because for those that are not here, there's a John Deere tractor convention
I think they ended today, but...
Yeah,
they do not know what to do with us.
Any more John Deere people in the elevator. The first time I saw one, I was like, wait, we're in Florida. Wait, can they use a tractor?
This far north, yes, but you go down a bit south, they just sink.
Because I just feel like if there has to be a moat around the Hooters, what on earth are you tractoring?
Oh man, I almost went into that Hooters. Just
but you couldn't cross the moat.
No, I couldn't cross the moat. I didn't have a gold piece to pay, car ride across the river of lies.
There could be so many episodes of this podcast in which we reference the damn Hooters. I mean,
it's about the moat, Sean. It's not really about the restaurant. It's about the moat.
Stop male gazing the Hooters. Really?
Oh, we were promising him nipple jokes earlier, and we never got there.
I could touch my nipples, but that might be a little awkward for the show.
I don't have a moat, so if we could just...
No, you should not have a moat. No moat's involved. Oh. So, okay, so you talked about Dune, and you talked about Storm Constantine as your influences, but it doesn't sound like your book is like those things at all. Have people compared you to other authors?
Yes, mostly to my pleasant bewilderment. The catalog page for my book, which means that the people at Tor wrote, says in the style of China Mayville and Jeff Vandermeer.
Well, there you go. That's not bad at all.
And some reviewers have said Gaiman-esque. I don't see any of that, with the exception of China Mayville is an influence. And I think when you're writing about a complicated, morbid, weird city, you gonna get some China. So
that
didn't surprise me.
So suggestive.
You gonna get some China, boy, here at the John Deere ICFA conference. I was really hoping for a fusion of the John Deere people and ICFA, but I think I was the only one.
No, I think, like, I heard people talking about the possibility of there being a flash fiction contest that was going to be judged on Sunday morning.
Yeah, I have to write something for that. I have to go collect my tarot cards from Francesca Myman and then go write a flash fiction story so that I can win a John Deere hat from Ellen Clayton.
So wait, collect tarot cards?
When y'all came to collect me from the bar, I had just handed over my cards to Francesca.
Oh, okay. This doesn't have to do with the flash fiction.
No, it has nothing to do with the flash. It's just me being weird, which is apparently
a thing.
But yeah, there is a flat there. I was told that if I turned in John Deere based flash fiction, I would have a chance at winning a John Deere hat. And at this point, that's...
You're saying flash fiction, not slash fiction.
Flash, up to 1,000 words.
With me, you can never be sure.
So, like, what I heard is that if you turn in a piece of flash that's under 1,000 words and it's John Deere related, it will be read in a blind submission, so, like, they won't know who wrote which thing, and Ellen Plagueis will judge it.
And give a John Deere
winner
hat.
And give them a John Deere hat.
Well,
but I don't know if they were actually successful in getting a John Deere hat.
They were. I've seen it.
Oh, they were.
Yes.
Okay, good.
Yes. No.
Last
no.
Time
I had to be baited.
Get one.
I had to be baited. This is.
Right.
I won't just work.
So
for,
we all
you know,
should like be dispersing
hats.
Immediately and writing flash fiction.
Well, I would except I feel confident that I'm going to win this one because if there is ever somebody who was born to make. I've been saying all week that the fantastic and John Deere go hand in hand and foot and hoof, and I just know I'm gonna win it. No, I just do. I believe that I can write something smutty and funny enough that it will get Ellen Clayton to give me that goddamn hat.
That's gonna have to, like, actually, because by the time this podcast goes live, someone will be like, readers, he did win. Or, alternately, he did not.
We regret to inform you that David Edison still lacks a John Deere hat, but did pick up a couple tractor salesmen.
Good enough. You probably still got a John Deere hat after that point.
I mean, maybe got some other John Deere merch as well.
I have a John Deere lunch tin at home. My friends went to the Mall of America and saw fit to bring me back a John Deere lunch tin.
I used to have a John Deere chuck toy for a long time. I don't know what happened to it.
I've never had a John Deere anything. You guys are so much luckier than I am, obviously, by this single metric.
You know, okay, I'll tell you what. If you don't win a John Deere hat, I will send you my tin.
You got it. That is a promise.
So no matter what, you win.
And then you'll have
told
to, like,
you I
post
was
a
win
selfie
something.
With it. So you'd be like, yeah.
Getting me to post selfies is not really a problem.
All right. So your book is called The Waking Engine. It's out now through Tor. People can buy it immediately.
Yes, and they should. They don't have to read it immediately, but they should buy it immediately.
Yep.
Okay, and when is the next one going to come out?
We are scheduled tentatively for May of 2015. My delivery date. I'm super pregnant. I have to turn the manuscript over in September, so it should be out by May of 2015.
Okay.
That's our tentative date.
All right, so where can people find you?
Please, you can find me on Twitter at at David Edison, like the inventor, no relation.
That was one of our questions.
Yes.
Absolutely not related. I come from a long line of Lithuanian Jews who changed their name at the drop of a hat. and I do other things at the drop of a hat, if it's a John Deere hat. you can find me on Twitter at David Edison. You can find me at davidedison.com. I'm also the editor of gaygamer.net. So if you are a video game enthusiast or a homosexual enthusiast, you might want to head over to gaygamer.net and see what the boys have all got cooking. I feel like there's some major other thing that I do, but there isn't. So it's just this phantom sense of loss.
Maybe it's you missing your tarot cards.
Damn it, Francesca Myman.
Well, excellent. Well, on that note, thank you very much for coming. Actually, kind of in the middle of the night, and when you should have been drinking and writing.
He was drinking.
He was drinking. And then we took him away from his drinking.
I'll go right back, don't worry. It's not a problem.
It's all good.
But thank you very much for coming on and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks.
And I will just say, based on you, how amusing you are for this, that next year, make sure you get in contact and we'll have you on the show for, again, like, for, we'll sit down, we'll read the whole book and that whole thing's happening.
Thank you for the compliment and the invitation. I will also be at, I don't know if y'all are going to be at ReaderCon, WISCon, and WorldCon, but I'm going to be
at WISCon. I won't be at WISCon this year, but I will be at ReaderCon and WorldCon, so you can find me there.
Well, and I'm fundraising currently to go to WorldCon.
So you can do it.
Yeah, I've got about a bit to go.
Are you Indiegogo'd or Kickstarter'd or?
GoFundMe.
So, what did you say to me?
I want you to GoFundMe.
Said I want your John Deere head. Boy.
GoFundMe, boy.
Whoa, this is becoming way too much of an innuendo. And on that note, awkward ending and scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.